arguing that more and more employers allow employees to do that with as the labor market has changed, and that's becoming less and less of a problem. But the point is that the LURC weighed those reports and considered them and found the fact that Mr. Beecher sustained a 60% loss of earning capacity at the circuit court level, and I know we're not reviewing their decision here, but that's the inquiry they undertook there. Was there credible and substantial evidence for the 60% opinion found by the Labor and Industry Review Commission? And the decision was that, yes, in fact, there was, and that was the end of the inquiry.
Counsel, where do you differ from your esteemed colleague there at the table with you? As I understand your position, that you are conceding that the Court of Appeals, or excuse me, you're conceding that LURC erred in considering Beecher's work search. Is that correct, or am I incorrect on that?
Good.
What's your position with regard to work search? Is the injured employee required to initiate a work search in order to establish a prima facie odd lot case?
No. I think it's one of the factors under DWD 80.34. I think in this particular case, the sense of reading their opinion that I got was that they thought it was important. I think it was the fact that it seemed to carry the most weight with them. His hypothesis is I can't work anymore, but he, in fact, never performed a job search, which they said he could have done more to help himself, basically, and he didn't.
But didn't he fall in, as I read the odd lot under the Larson's workers' compensation law, you don't have to. He doesn't have to look for work, does he?
No. No, Justice Wilcox. I would agree. I don't think that he has to, but when they look at those, I think it's about eight factors, A through H. You know, geography is a factor. Where
Right. Okay.
Sure. And one of those is job search.
But what I'm saying is that it seemed to me that this particular person fell under that category where he didn't have, you know, I thought there was a prima facie case where he just, because of his injuries, that he did not have to search for work.
I agree. I think they made a prima facie case, too. I don't disagree with that. I think really where the LURC got into, the Labor and Industry Review Commission got into it in regard to those factors, weighing them, was that he didn't do a job search. Do you necessarily have to do one to qualify? No, I don't know about that, but I think it's one of the many factors, and they certainly, in this particular case, they gave it weight, and it was their job to. I would like to also discuss some of the Court of Appeals decision, and again, I know you're not reviewing that, but I think perhaps there's something to be learned there. I think one place they made a mistake is they got into the area of finding facts rather than looking to see whether there was credible and substantial evidence. At page 13 of their decision, they disagreed with the Labor and Industry Review Commission's opinion as to whether the restrictions that Mr. Beecher received allowed him to return to full-time work. I think the experts agreed that it was an 8-hour release. The LURC found that it was an 8-hour release. But then the Court of Appeals said that they thought they got that wrong. Well, I think they overstepped their bounds in that regard. It was the job of the Labor and Industry Review Commission to make that determination. And at 13, they essentially said, it doesn't say he can work full-time, and that seemed to be one of the factors in regard to their decision. They also, I think, improperly or overread the Balshefsky case, which in our area basically stands as a rule of evidence in regard to the what it takes to make a prima facie case for workers' compensation. And they were focusing on the fact that Mr. Beecher lined up a lot with Ms. Balshefsky, but really what that case stands for is it kind of started the advent of using vocational experts.
Counsel, I'm not hearing you right, but I thought Balshefsky, and I'm just did not address what is necessary to demonstrate a prima facie case. I had difficulty hearing what you just say about Balshefsky.
I think it stands for the proposition that what it takes to make a prima facie odd lot case in Wisconsin, it basically acts as a rule of evidence, and they were taking it fact for fact, saying it should be a similar outcome. But in Balshefsky, there was no defense respondent vocational expert. They ended up remanding it. We don't really know whether Ms. Balshefsky ever ended up being a perm total or what her position was. So I don't think it's an analogous case at all. The Court of Appeals also commented that the Labor and Industry Review Commission's comment in their decision that he could have done more to help himself. They said, well, that's not the law. You're holding him to too high of a standard. But where that comment comes from, if you read the entire decision, is that he again, it comes back to the work search, that they didn't think he had done anything in regard to work search, vocational retraining, or any of those issues to prove that he couldn't work.
I follow up Justice Wilcox's question. How do you make that prima facie case?
Well, under 102.17, it says that basically it's almost like an utterance. If a qualified vocational expert says that the person is odd lot perm total, I think you've made your prima facie case at that point. And then I really think they get down to evidence weighing. So that's why we believe he made a prima facie case for perm total. But where
the mere submission of a report from, was it McCormick or whatever his name is?
McReynolds.
That was enough?
Yes. I think they didn't think it carried any weight. They didn't think it was a credible opinion, and they rejected it. But I think they got to weighing the evidence in that regard.
Counselor, in regard to credibility, is the expert, is the Lurk's opinion a determination that one expert was more credible than other, one vocational expert?
I think it's reflected in there. They didn't really adopt either expert. They rejected my expert.
Right.
They rejected their expert. They weighed the evidence, which is their charge, and they made their decision.
But if there's a, well, I guess my concern is this, why wouldn't they accept an expert's testimony? To me, it seems they wouldn't accept it if they didn't think it was credible or something in the report made them believe the expert couldn't have drawn the conclusion they did. Do you agree with that?
I do.
Okay, so if it's a credibility determination, don't they have to tell us why, and don't they have to confer with the ALJ about why the ALJ found one of those experts credible but Lurk did not?
They can conduct a credibility conference. I don't know whether they did or not. They did explain in their opinion why they rejected both experts. So even though they said he didn't make a prima facie case, they got on to weighing both of the reports, and they said Ms. Panasich's report didn't explain the obstacles he was going to have to overcome to reenter employment. On the other hand, they also said that Mr. McReynolds' report was inadequate, too, that he didn't...
But they thought he didn't look at the full-time employment possibility sufficient, correct? I mean, that's
right.
One of their main concerns.
Basically, things kept getting better for Mr. Beecher in regard to his restrictions, and no matter how good they got, he couldn't be disabused from his position. The guy was odd lot firm total.
Right. I have to tell you, I still have some problems with Lurk just coming up with a number on their own. I don't know where they get, you know, your statutory authority is fine, but I have some difficulty with their expertise. I mean, you hear you have people that all they do all day long is vocational evaluations, and certainly Lurk is free to find they're not credible and to reject them both, but I don't know where, without anything else in the record, they come up with a number on their own, and we're supposed to sustain that number. It really bothers me.
It's an interesting thing that we debate often in our practice, too. I mean, they're entitled to do it by statute, and this case is certainly heightening everyone in our workers' comp bars area, our awareness of that.
Right.
However,
they don't say in their report why they picked that number. They don't say in their report what they're picking from this one and that one and why they're coming up with it. I mean, I read it again over lunch, and I had read it when I first read all the stuff that you sent in, and I find it pretty slim pickings, you know, to look at that number. They got a paragraph that contains one sentence, and that's how they come up with it on page 10 of Lurk's decision. I guess that's why I asked you, is there something else in the record that maybe they didn't reference, but if we looked at that and looked at the record, we would know. But there isn't anything else that you know of.
Justice, I'm out of time.
Yeah, that, yeah sure.
Not really. In terms of a Labor and Industry Review Commission, you know, I run about 200 files. This is all I do. I read a number of these, unfortunately, or perhaps fortunately. And this is a fairly thorough decision from them. I think it was a 10 or 12 pager. Sometimes you can see they really seem to be trying to write a very low surface area decision so that it's harder to appeal. But they gave a fair amount of analysis as to why they were rejecting both sides. I guess it's all relative, but.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Our sound system is being replaced, so we are using individual microphones in this manner. So sometimes we may have trouble hearing with you, and we will tell you that. It's not your fault. It's just a sound problem. Mr. Sabota, representing LURC.
Let me, Your Honor, I could make a couple of quick main points and then probably, based on the questions that the court has, Mr. Wade, probably try to address some of those and I can help explain
Wade's position and the Commission's position. First thing I wanted to tell you about this case is, and maybe this would be of interest to the students too, do you know how much money Mr. Beecher got for the 60% LOEC award in this case? If you look on pages 10 and 11 of the commission decision, you'll find that it's approximately $100,400. Now, I've been practicing workers' compensation law in Wisconsin for over 30 years, and let me tell you, Your Honors, that over $100,000 in a workers' compensation case is not chicken feed. That is a substantial amount of money. Clearly, it's not 100% perm total, which is obviously what Mr. Beecher wanted and what the ALJ, who heard the case initially, awarded. But I remember in the Morellas case, this court decided just a few years ago, the question, and I believe it was from Justice Bradley, was how much was a 3% functional permanent disability worth? And it wasn't worth very much money at all. So let's be clear on this case that the commission decision did not give Mr. Beecher a big zero. He got substantial disability at the rate of 60% loss of earning capacity.
But counsel, I think it's all relative. I mean, if your earning capacity were reduced and your earnings were reduced 60% for the rest of your work life, that might add up to millions and millions of dollars.
You haven't seen my pay stub recently.
My point being, this is for his work life, for the rest of his working life.
I understand that.
$100,000 sounds
good. And I don't mean to diminish the difference between 100% perm total and 60, but I want to get that up front and make it clear that, again, I don't think there's any dispute from either side of the table that $100,000 is a lot of money.
Getting that now?
Correct.
Fighting the 40%.
Okay, let me make clear the difference. It's not a straight 100% numerical. Permanent total disability at 100% means that Mr. Beecher, under the ALJ's award, would have been awarded the temporary total disability for the rest of his life.
For the rest of his, okay, so
correct.
He was 58 at the time, I'm just looking at the facts.
Right.
So he, let's see, that would be a couple, so he's in his early 60s now. And he gets it for the, this is the not working life, the rest of his life.
Now, you're talking about a perm total award, Your Honor?
Well, I'm talking about the 60%.
No, the 60% is a straight calculation. 600 weeks of,
of
permanent disability.
Right. But the permanent would be,
Right. Whereas 100%, you get the highest amount for the rest of your life. And what would happen in the case of Mr. Beecher, if he unfortunately were to die, that basically turns then into a death benefit for his widow. So there is something there, you know, for her, too.
Counsel, does this case in large part boil down to Lurk saying that in order to establish a prima facie case for an odd lot, that the injured employee has to put in evidence of work search?
The case, Your Honor, and I wish I could make this a little bit simpler for everybody, but unfortunately it's not that simple. We're asking you in this case, and I think it's clear from the briefs and the argument, to pick up that so-called second half, the corollary part of Professor Larson's rule, which everyone agrees was not an issue in the Balchevsky case because there was no job search issue in Balchevsky. Now, that, can I call that the second half of the rule just for shorthand purposes?
For longhand purposes, what you're referring, though, to is that section which deals with non-odd lot cases. Is that correct?
Okay, and that's where it gets real ambiguous. That heading, the bold letter heading above the Larson rule, is real unfortunate language. Here's what I'd like to do, Your Honors, and I tried to do this at the oral argument in the Court of Appeals, and it didn't work very well. But the case that I think... Okay. The out-of-state case, which I think is the best precedent to guide you in this case, is the one from the state of Wyoming called Shapanovich versus United States Steel Corporation. I'd ask you to read not only the majority decision in Shapanovich, which clearly supports the commission, but I also want you to take a look at the dissent in that case, which was written by Justice Rose. And I'm looking particularly at page 531 of 669 Pacific 2nd. And Justice Rose does the best analysis of those two parts of the Larson rule that I've seen in any published appellate decision. And let me paraphrase it this way, if I can. The first part of the Larson rule, which is the one you used in Balchevsky, basically says that a person who is really, really bad off, in other words, the clearly disabled person, once they make their prima facie showing, they clearly shift the burden to the employer to show that suitable light work of a regular nature is available. And Justice Rose says, and I'm quoting, if the employer does not do that, then the employee prevails. Okay, then he goes on to the second half of the rule, which is what we're asking you to pick up in this case. And he says, but not everybody is going to be as bad off as, let's say, Mrs. Balchevsky was. And so he says, the second paragraph describes those who will not, those with a limited or specialized impairment who are not obviously unemployable. And he says, that doesn't mean that these folks can't get perm total, but they must make an additional showing not required of the Mrs. Balchevsky type. And that showing is that a reasonable effort to make, to find suitable work has been made. And here's what Justice Rose then says on page 531, and I'm quoting verbatim. Thus, the odd lot doctrine is available to those who are not obviously employable, as well as to those who are, period. However, the threshold showing differs. those with less obvious injuries have a greater showing to make, end of quote. That's what the commission says this case is. This is Beecher. He was not an obviously unemployable employee who came under the first half of the rule to get perm total. He has to make the higher threshold showing under the second part of the rule, and that entails a reasonable job search. And
I'm sorry, if I could just say
that's where Mr. Wade and I differ.
The job search. Mr. Wade would say you don't need a job search to be an odd lot, to make prima facie on an odd lot. And you say you do need a job search in this situation in order to establish a prima facie for an odd lot.
I don't want to put words in Mr. Wade's mouth, but I can clearly tell you what the commission said in this decision is for Mr. Beecher to prove 100% perm total odd lot, he did have to show a job search, and they were convinced that on the record before them, he did not do that. He made the one-time trip to the job service office in Kenosha.
As I interpreted the comments of Mr. Wade, that he disagreed with LIRT with regard to that. Let me tell you the problem I have with your approach. First of all, you say, we rely on Larson, and your point is the Larson. But then you say, oh, but Larson should have chosen different headings, because if you follow the plain words of Larson, you lose. You got to go under Larson's heading of non-odd lot, what you need to do when you're a non-odd lot to establish a prima facie. And I think I naturally would say, well, what do you have to do to establish an odd lot, which is a prima facie under an odd lot? So I have that problem. I also think, why should I go to Wyoming? I mean, the Wisconsin version of interpreting workers' compensation law, that is the treatise for Wisconsin, is this, you know, the Neal treatise, and updated March 2003, and the way that in 5.31 it's spelled out there, talking about Belshevsky, sets forth the Belshevsky figure, you know, the three things, quality, dependability, or quantity that are reasonable, you know, the mantra. Then he goes on to say that the Belshevsky case is notable for holding that when an employee presents prima facie proof that because of these factors, the Belshevsky factors, that then the burden shifts. So Neal disagrees with your interpretation. The words, the headings of Larson disagree with your interpretation. So why should I rely on a Wyoming Supreme Court case unless I want to change the law? If I want to rely on the way the law appears to be now, it's something different.
Okay, let me go point by point if I can.
Thank you.
First, forget about that bold-faced heading. It's like, you know, in our statutes where they sometimes have the same type of descriptive heading at the beginning of a statute. The way I understand this court's rule is that so-called descriptive heading, if it differs from the actual language of the statute, is legally irrelevant. I ask you to take the same approach with regard to the heading in the Larson treatise. It doesn't mean what it could be literally interpreted to mean, okay? It's a red herring. If you look at all of the cases which are cited in the Larson treatise, many of which are cited in the commission brief, you'll see that none of them bought the so-called heading argument. And Shapanovich, to me, is the best example of a court that didn't buy that. And let me, if I can point out briefly, and I know the red light is on, but at the top of page 529, and this is the majority decision in Shapanovich, and I'm quoting again, other jurisdictions in this context have held that an employee in circumstances similar to those of the appellant must show that reasonable efforts have been made to obtain suitable employment in order to meet their burden of proof and shift the burden of proof to the employer. And could I take just one stab, if I have the court's indulgence, at the second half of the argument, the Danis Neal treatise? Okay, Danis and Neal, the way you quoted it to me, Your Honor, didn't say a word that I heard you mention about the effect of DWD 8034 and or 102.17.7a. They basically paraphrased the holding in Balchuski. To me, the treatise doesn't say enough about the change in the law, in other words, the rule and the statute that came after Balchuski in point of time. And our position clearly is that particularly the rule added more odd lot factors to the equation than this court set forth in Balchuski. And job search is one of the specific ones that the rule added. So to me, the Danis Neal treatise makes the same error that the Court of Appeals did in this case. They don't take into effect the effect of the rule and the statute, which are crucial in this case.
Could I ask you, are you saying that the requisite amount of proof to establish prima facie that someone is a odd lot employee has changed from 1977 to 2001?
Okay, you said the words, was it requisite amount?
Whatever the employee has to show
right.
to get into that category,
right.
has that changed since 1977?
Okay, let me try it this way, Your Honor. My recollection is that at the time of the Balchuski decision, the Larson treatise reads exactly the same way, the one and the two-part thing that it does now. But in 1977, at the time of Balchuski, we didn't have the administrative rule, DWD 8034. And then also remember, job search wasn't an issue in Balchuski. I was the attorney of record for the employer in Balchuski, and I had no contra evidence to John Rogge, the vocational expert to Balchuski. So I can't say that if Beecher had arisen in 1977, that I wouldn't be back then making the same argument to you saying, well, you ought to adopt both parts of the Larson rule, da-da-da-da-da, because that isn't the way it developed. But I am telling you right now that I think it was a terrible error for the Court of Appeals in this case to basically write half a decision. They gave you an interpretation of Balchuski, which I strongly disagree with, but they gave you no interpretation of the rule and the statute. And as I told you in my reply brief, I don't think the Court of Appeals did their homework on this case. And it's terribly troubling to an appellate counsel who makes arguments to a court and doesn't get the courtesy of having those arguments addressed. So I can't put it any stronger than that to say that the present state of the law, I can tell you I'm confident in Wisconsin, is Balchuski, supplemented by DWD 8034, and finally, to answer Justice Rogensack's question, 102.17.7a clearly gives the commission the right to pick their own number. And, Your Honor, if you would look at, in our brief, we cite that same footnote that Mr. Wade talked about, and it cites a case from Eau Claire County Circuit Court, which Judge Barland, who I'm sure you know of his reputation, cited a case called Gray versus Lurk. And Judge Barland, and I think he made a perfect analogy, said, to me, under the statute, this is just like a highway condemnation case where the experts come in with their competing dollar amounts, and the condemnation agency is free to look at those and say, okay, you say 50,000, you say 200,000, we don't like either one of those, we're going to pick 100,000, and that's perfectly proper.
Well, but with all due respect, Counselor, there's a little difference between picking dollar amounts. All of us have some familiarity with dollar amounts. I would personally have no ability to determine if someone was 10% disabled or 50% disabled. So I have some question about whether the folks who sit as LURC, who are lawyers, have that ability either. And I read the statute, and I read what you have in your, and I appreciate Justice Barlin's reputation, which is certainly fine, but I still find it troubling.
Okay. Can I just answer that by saying, of course, that this court over the years has clearly said that the members of the Industrial Commission, be they lawyers or non-lawyers, have expertise, and I guess it's pretty much an institutional expertise in all realms of workers' compensation law. They have it in disability. We know as a result of the Brown decision, they have it in bad faith. They have it in the safety violation cases under 10257. And I think if it comes down to a question whose expertise is most important in a case like this, I vote for the commission over the Court of Appeals in District 2 every time, Your Honor.
Well, I don't think that's what we're comparing. At least that's not what I'm comparing.
Well said.
Mr. Sabota.
Counsel. Justice Press.
I'm sorry. As I understand Mr. Wade's position, all that is necessary to get over the threshold of a prima facie case is a report from an expert. There is a report from an expert. Okay. Is he wrong?
Okay. Again, drawing on my own practice in workers' comp, Your Honor, I tend to agree with Mr. Wade because what tends to happen, you know, these cases are tried all at once. You know, they're not bifurcated where we try the medical evidence in one segment and the vocational. So, yeah, in a run-of-the-mill workers' compensation case, and let's take a back surgery case because that's an easy one, you come in with a report on a WC-16B from your doctor, and it says, you had a laminectomy, and that's worth either 5%, 10% functional disability. But I'm a doctor. You go to the vocational expert, and the vocational expert comes in with their certified report and says, yes, on the basis of the laminectomy and looking at the factors in DWD 8034, I hereby opine to a reasonable degree of vocational probability that this person is perm total under the odd lot doctrine. Okay, if you put that in as the applicant at a hearing and the employer sat on their hands and did nothing by way of rebutting evidence, you win under the first part of the Larson rule and you win under Balchevsky, okay? You with me? All right. Now, let's say, though, that in that same situation, Mr. Wade for the employer comes in and he's got a doctor and says, well, okay, I'll concede that it's 5 or 10% under the administrative code for the laminectomy, but I think this person had a good result and, you know, the limitations are such that this person could do light work, medium work, whatever the jargon is. And then Mr. Wade brings in a competing vocational expert who says, no, this person is not odd lot. This person needs to go out on the job market and see what's out there, and I predict that if this person did that, they'd find jobs in these areas. And that's, I think, part two of the Larson analysis, okay? But to the extent that if the case were not, how shall I say, hardly tried, you could do it on the basis, I believe, of just 116B and one certified vocational report that in effect says the magic words of Balchevsky. Yes.
One last question. You sent to the court a letter dated January 5th.
Right.
I don't know quite how to interpret that letter. Is
okay.
That some sort of confession of error?
No. I called the court's attention to the Aikens case, which was called to my attention because of a moot court we did at our office on this case. And the thing that I thought the Aikens case might help this court do is basically say, maybe we don't need a long, detailed oral argument and or decision from the court on this prima facie case issue. Maybe all we need is a nice, simple decision that starts off saying, the issue in this case is whether the commission could reasonably conclude that Mr. Beecher sustained a 60% loss of earning capacity. And that's the only issue we have to worry about. And if the court wants to do that, and I think Aikens supports that proposition, you can basically take the best of both Mr. Wade and myself and say, forget about Balchuski, forget about whether he did or did not make a prima facie case. The commission's found 60%, and as all you have to do is determine under your applicable standard of review, the same way you did in Kelly Brown, as to whether the commission's ultimate finding is sustainable on the basis of the record and applicable Wisconsin law. And I would not be at all troubled by this court writing such a decision. Because, like I said, you might save yourself a lot of intellectual travail, as you said in the Disher case, by just forgetting about this prima facie analysis. The other thing from the practical standpoint, Your Honor, practitioners in the workers' comp area tell me, how do we know at a workers' comp hearing, if I'm representing the applicant and I put in my reports, medical and vocational, have I made a prima facie case such that Mr. Wade, my worthy opponent, has to start rebutting? Because there's no point in the proceedings where the judge stands up and says, yes, a prima facie case has been made by the applicant. Yes, Mr. Wade, you must now come forward with your rebutting evidence. It doesn't happen that way. So therefore, if you want to basically look at just the ultimate question in this case, is a 60% award reasonable? I think that's a perfectly reasonable and logical way to go.
Well, counsel, my question goes to why should we have these two types of cases? One, if the person, as you put it, very badly off, and the other for somebody who's not so badly off. Because as soon as you start categories, you get to somebody who's right and not so sure,
right? Yep.
And so if you're in that not so sure, then it might make a lot of difference to somebody as to who has the burden of proof of going forth. So why, I don't understand why you got two categories, why
okay.
they arose
well.
That way. And why not just have one category and just say, you prove disabled, you tell us how badly disabled you are, and the concept that you're demanding full permanent
right.
disability. The other, the employer then has to say, oh no, one, the meds are wrong. Two, even accepting the meds, he can get employed.
Right.
That would make it very simple. Why is it complicated?
Well, okay, let me answer it this way.
Don't answer me, Larson. I want to know
okay.
why.
Okay. Because, number one, we do that in workers' compensation all the time. We draw lines.
Well, we do that all the way in the law, but if you can get
yeah.
rid of some of the lines, you ought to do that.
But, you know, we've heard this argument so many times recently, and I know we heard it last in the traveling employee cases. They were clamoring for a black letter rule, and they said, we have to have this line of demarcation as to when a person is on a personal deviation or when they're doing something, you know, that's reasonably related. And the answer that I thought this court clearly gave is no. We don't have to draw black letter lines in workers' comp. The commission and the ALJs are the people who do that. They're the experts. They're the ones who are supposed to draw the lines.
They're drawing a line between someone who's very badly off and not so badly off.
Well, because of the fact that that gets into both, I think, a medical and a vocational question. And so I guess I'm grappling with the fact that who are you going to rely on to make what you want to be the simple determination as to whether a person is obviously unemployable or not so obviously unemployable. That, to me, is a pretty hard classification to make. And I guess let me do the easiest example. A person who in an industrial accident, well, a quadriplegic isn't going to help us because
that's... Let's just take this case.
Okay.
In this case, I got the right case, the doctor writes a report and indicates that, he's not flat on his back all the
right.
time.
Right.
He can stand for 1 hour in two. He can sit for 1 hour in two. He can do this for. He can limit his kneeling, limit the crawling. So he's just not totally incapacitated. He can
right.
do some things within limitations.
Right.
Which says to the reader, well, maybe there is a job where you get up every hour. You sit down every hour. You don't crawl, et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's the point, isn't it, about this case?
Right.
So it seems to me the employee brings in this kind of medical report. You can then say it's up to the employer. I don't care where you put. You can do anything, but to make it as simple as possible, that's his job. The employer's job is to bring in evidence that he can find a job. I mean, you can do it that way. You can do it that the employee has to bring in this kind of proof from a doctor as to what he can and can't do, and he's got to then say, I can't get a job that fits that.
Okay, but are you saying, number one, that the employer either has to take him back with that same employer or go out and actually find him a job?
Well, what do you do now?
Well, we do a lot of different things, obviously.
I'd stay with that. I'm not bothered by
yeah.
that. I'm not putting that into the mix.
Okay.
I'm just trying to get who has to do what in what order. And it just seems to me once you divide your employees into two categories, then you got a categorization. You got different rules in those two categories. You don't know exactly where the lurk is going to say which they fit. It looks like a trap to me. And you're supposed to be simple in workers' comp, right?
I agree with that. But I'm going to say, Your Honor, that I don't think the two-part breakdown that I'm asking you to approach is all that onerous. And the other thing that I think is really important, and we really haven't touched on this, is this Court has clearly said many times there's a mitigation of damages element in workers' comp, which is solely the responsibility of the applicant. And I think under the scenario that you're giving, it's basically throwing that concept pretty much out the window and putting all of the onus on the employer. The crucial thing about this case and the young woman, unfortunately, who's now deceased, who wrote the briefs for Mr. Wade's side, made a real telling point that she said if you look at the DWD 8034 factors, there are only two of them that are really in the total control of the employee, and that's vocational retraining to some extent, but the other one is job search. That is solely based upon the motivation and willingness of the injured employer to go out and make an effort. And to me, you're basically saying this Court may be condoning people not going out and making that effort, and I don't think that's good workers' comp policy.
Okay. In an ideal world, what would you do?
In an ideal world, I'd ask you to take the two-part test, and if you want me, I know the question's going to become, and I've heard it again from the applicant side of the table, is, well, what is our responsibility then? And my only answer can be, and it's the one that I think from the Minnesota Supreme Court, the Redgate case, says that a job search has got to be one that's reasonable under all of the circumstances. And that is going to vary with each case depending especially on the age, education, and geographic location of the injured worker. It's going to make a big difference whether I'm looking for a job in Madison or in Rice Lake, for example.
And that would be part of the prima facie case in the second part.
Well, yeah, it is, because that's one of the factors in DWD 8034, and my proposition is all of the factors in DWD 8034 are conceivably part of your prima facie case.
Thank you. I think your 12 minutes are up. Mr. Kelly gave you more time to think. Daniel J. Kelly, representing Ralphie Beecher.
May it please the Court. My name is Daniel Kelly. I'm with Trinity Lloyd Kelly Fitz and Knurr, Racine, Wisconsin. I'm appearing on behalf of the plaintiff appellant, Ralph Beecher. This is a case that falls squarely all fours on the Polchevsky case. The facts are virtually indistinguishable. It's almost difficult to imagine a case that could come more closely to Beecher. Their ages are virtually identical. Their work histories are very similar. They both have similar back injuries, back surgeries, fusions, similar physical restrictions. In Bolshevsky, the administrative agency said, no, this person isn't totally disabled. This person's only 55% disabled, similar to what the commission did in this case. The court in Bolshevsky said, no, Ms. Bolshevsky presented an opinion of a vocational expert establishing that this person is permanently and totally disabled. There's nothing inherently incredible about that opinion. She has established a prima facie case. Therefore, looks fine to the contrary. Therefore, the burden shifts to the employer to establish that jobs are regularly and continually available to Ms. Bolshevsky. The court found as a matter of law that the evidence presented established a prima facie case. It gave a stamp of approval to the use of the vocational expert opinion as the means of establishing, or at least a means of establishing, a prima facie case. Note that the court in Bolshevsky did not remand the court back to Lurk to give her to tell her to go conduct a job search. It remanded the case back to Lurk, to the administrative agency at that time, for determination as to whether the prima facie case that had been made had been rebutted.
Mr. Kelly, if I can interrupt for a minute, in Bolshevsky, was there any testimony presented by a vocational expert on the other side?
No, not on the defense.
Isn't that a distinction between your case and Bolshevsky?
I suggest that goes to the question of whether or not the prima facie case was rebutted, and that's why the court remanded the case back so that the defense could get a vocational report to try to rebut the prima facie case. But it said, as a matter of law, the prima facie case is established. And nothing about the, I'm sorry.
I don't want to make Mr. Wade's argument for him, but it's my understanding that he concedes that Lurk was wrong when Lurk said there was not a prima facie case established. But he says, we rebutted the prima facie case. What's your position on that? I'm not sure I clearly understand where all of you fit.
The question, if it is agreed that a prima facie case was established, pursuant to Bolshevsky, the burden then shifts to the employer to establish that work is regularly and continually available to Mr. Beecher. Lurk never made a finding of fact on that point because it never found the establishment of a prima facie case. So there is no finding of fact by Lurk, and both defendant respondents cite arguments in their brief stating that this court can't find facts. It has to decide whether or not there's evidence to support the findings that Lurk did in fact make.
So your position would be that we ought to remand this case to Lurk to give Lurk the opportunity to make the findings that you're urging?
Correct.
And do you agree with Mr. Wade? That's what he's saying also?
Well, he says
there's the matter's rebutted. So is his position like yours? There still is the need for a remand to Lurk?
I, I disagree that the matter has been rebutted, that the prima facie case has been rebutted. If Lurk found that the evidence presented here established a prima facie case, I would probably seek to come back here and argue again that it did not do that because the evidence presented by the defense in this case didn't provide any information whatsoever regarding the existence of any job openings. It just describes certain numbers of jobs existing in the state of Wisconsin. So if that issue were before this court, I would argue that the evidence presented by the defense in this case was not legally sufficient. But at this stage, I think the proper method of proceeding is to determine that the evidence in this case establishes a prima facie case as a matter of law, and then remand the case back to Lurk. Maybe Lurk will find that the prima facie case was not rebutted. Certainly they did not, as the questions from Justice Rogensack early on indicated, the Lurk in this case was not overly impressed with the opinions of the defense vocational experts, so there's no reason for this court to conclude, as the defendant petitioners or defendant respondents would ask you to, that Lurk would automatically rule the same way if it placed the burden of proof on the proper party.
Counselor, you know, if we remand it back to Lurk, they can only make the findings on the evidence that's already presented. They're not going to have another hearing, correct? Or do they have the opportunity to let the parties present additional evidence?
I would say that generally, it depends on the court's order. The Court of Appeals in this case actually ordered that the defense be given the opportunity to present additional evidence. I don't think the court is required to do that. I think the court has it within its authority to, typically what is done is the court says the decision set aside, there should be a finding that the prima facie case was established and the matter is remanded for further proceedings. And then typically it would be up to Lurk to decide whether to issue a new decision based upon the evidence that's established or whether an additional hearing is required. But certainly there's precedent for this court doing either.
Okay. All right.
And even for just saying we find that as a matter of law the evidence doesn't support rebuttal of the prima facie case, I mean, that would be wonderful, but I have not
I have a question about that. Do you have an opinion about whether the evidence that the employer must provide to rebut the prima facie case has to show actual jobs, or can the employer simply just say, well, he has these characteristics and there are these kind of jobs available within the state?
The Bolshevsky case, citing the Larson treatise, says it's not enough to say this person can do light work and light work exists.
Mm-hmm.
It takes more than that. You have to show that work is regularly and continually available.
In particular types of jobs or particular jobs? Do you know the difference I'm looking at?
I think that I know the distinction. Not aware of any appellate court decision in Wisconsin that addresses that issue. Certainly, I would argue that they would need to establish that jobs are available, that exist and are available on a regular basis.
Mm-hmm.
The information cited by the defense vocational expert in this case just says there are X number of jobs that exist within the light and sedentary categories.
Right. It doesn't talk about the kinds of jobs or where they might be available.
Where they might be available. Doesn't provide the particular source. Didn't provide any information about whether those jobs require standing all day as many light jobs would. Doesn't about sitting, et cetera. And it provided no information whatsoever regarding whether any of those jobs are available or open or ever become open. Some jobs basically never become open to the general public. Mr. McReynolds did conduct such an investigation in this case. Mr. McReynolds took the restrictions assessed by the doctor and checked with job service. And that in reviewing and checking with job service regarding what work was available, he determined that there was not a single job opening in existence in Kenosha County or listed with the Kenosha County Job Service that was consistent with Mr. Beecher's physical, mental, and educational limitations.
Counsel, with regard to the issue of what's necessary to establish a prima facie case in an odd lot matter, specifically with regard to the requirement of the injured employee to conduct a job search in order to establish a prima facie case. As I understand it, both you and Mr. Wade are in agreement that the law does not require job search for a prima facie case. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Is the difference between the two of you with regard to that primarily then one of sufficiency of evidence, Mr. Wade saying, admittedly, a prima facie case has been established, but we rebutted it, and the record shows that we rebut it, and your position being that it was not rebutted, but both of you agreeing that Lurk was wrong in the job search analysis requirement?
I believe that Mr. Wade and I are in agreement that Lurk was wrong. Mr. Wade and I part company in that I think the question of who has the burden of proof after a prima facie case is established matters. I believe you can't automatically conclude that Lurk would have reached the same conclusion had it placed the burden of proof on the defense in this case as it should have.
But does Mr. Wade, maybe I'm missing something, after a prima facie case has been established, I thought as to the law, there was an agreement that then the employer has the burden showing that the claimant is, in fact, employable.
I believe he may agree to that, but I don't want to speak for him, but I believe the point that I disagree with that I think he is making is that this Court should find for Lurk that the case was rebutted, but I don't think Lurk found that. I don't think you can conclude from reading Lurk's decision that it found that the evidence presented by the defense was sufficient to rebut the prima facie case.
What's wrong with Mr. Sobota's approach from your perspective?
Firstly, I don't believe his approach is consistent with Bolshevsky, which states the law of this case. The law of the state. Bolshevsky says, prima facie case, in that case, you had this vocational expert who gave these opinions. That's one way by which you can establish a prima facie case. Therefore, the burden should shift. The request that this Court extend the law to include this additional Larson section probably should be directed to the legislature rather than to the Court, because the case established by Bolshevsky is clear. If you want to change it, go to the legislature and seek a change regarding the burden of proof in a permanent total disability case. And even if the Court chooses to consider whether or not it wants to extend the law, I respectfully suggest to this Court that that would be a very bad idea. As the questioning from Chief Justice Abramson indicated, what's to be gained by this? If there's somebody who is, first of all, what is meant by obviously disabled or not obviously disabled? It's not defined anywhere. It's not defined by Lurk. It's not defined by the courts or any statutes. If we assume that there is this distinction, why, if there is a person who is not obviously disabled, but there is, whatever that means, if there are no jobs that exist that the person is capable of performing, so that the person is, in fact, odd lot term total, why are we denying that person benefits? The result is something which almost happened, which I believe one could say happened in this case. Beecher is being denied total disability benefits as sort of a penalty for not conducting more of a job search, whatever that means. Nobody identified any job openings that Mr. Beecher, any jobs that Mr. Beecher could perform, any job openings. No, the testimony from Mr. McReynolds establishes that Mr. Beecher could have applied for every single job opening in Kenosha County Job Service and would not have been qualified for a single job. So, according to Lurch's decision, Mr. Beecher is denied benefits because he didn't apply for jobs that he wasn't qualified for. The rule that Lurk is asking this court to adopt in a case where a person is fully disabled requires the employee to engage in this hoop jumping and game playing as even when the person is fully disabled. And there's really no reason for this, for that to be the law of the state. It would be silly, in my opinion, for that to be the law of the state.
No, yes, maybe in the first year in law school you hear the words prima facie, and it's bandied about. I've probably written it a few times myself. And the more I listen to this argument, the more I know that I don't understand what that means. So what is a prima facie case in this area? And is it just the burden of going forward with the evidence up to a certain point and then the burden of persuasion shifts to the employer? Is that what we're talking about? And just give me what is would be the simplest showing of a prima facie case in under these facts, that you would think you met that, and then tell me what happens afterwards.
Okay. In terms of the question of what is a prima facie case, the best thing in this context, the best thing I can do is simply direct the court's opinion to the Bolshevsky decision. In that case, the evidence consisted of medical opinions regarding the, or evidence regarding the employee's age, education, work history,
and ability.
And abilities, and a vocational opinion that said, based upon all of this and my knowledge of the labor market, there is no reasonably stable labor market for this person. Okay, so what is a prima facie case in this context? I believe that is a prima facie case. And then what is the bare bones amount that could establish a prima facie case?
All right.
The medical opinions and the vocational report.
All right. You've done that, you say.
That and more, yes.
All right. Now, what's the burden on the employer?
To establish that jobs are regularly and continuously available. By that it means that there are job openings that regularly, that not just once, there's not just one job the person may be able to get, you know, on a good day, but there are jobs that regularly come available that when a person goes and searches for a job, that regularly there'll be some that the person can at least compete for, and that with people who would at least consider hiring that person.
And then what do you have to do if the employer shows that?
Well, I would have to, if the employer is completely successful in establishing that, I would have lost my claim of total disability. What I would have to do is establish that that's not true, that this employer, this job that they cite as being appropriate, in fact, a person can't do it if a person can only engage in standing and dynamic walking for no more than 4 hours a day. In fact, the job requires standing 5 hours a day or whatever.
And you would say that's true for someone who's obviously, to use Mr. Sabota's word, obviously disabled about as well as those who are not so obviously disabled.
Yes. I mean, certainly that evidence would be true either way.
Thank you.
You sent a letter to the court as well.
Yes.
And I interpreted that letter to say basically that you won this case and that although it might be remanded, new evidence shouldn't be introduced, that Lurk should be required to interpret the evidence that's already been introduced. And I understood Mr. Sabota's position to be there should be no new trial here. Evidence has been put in. We've made findings of fact.
Regarding my intent on the letter, I didn't really have any specific intent on that point one way or the other. My intent in the letter was to state that if you look at the actual court action in the case cited by Mr. Sobota, in that case, the court said the finder of fact has applied the incorrect rule of law. If you apply the correct rule of law, we don't know how they would conclude, so the case should be sent back to the finder of fact for a determination. As to what the appropriate remand would be as to whether there should be the opportunity to present additional evidence or not. Certainly when I suggested to the court that if the court is going to extend the law to add this new provision, that Mr. Beecher be given the opportunity to meet that provision in the same way that the defense in Bolshevsky was given an opportunity, Mr. Sobota said, responded, no, that's not right. He had his chance. I mean, certainly that argument would seem to apply just as well for the defense in this case if that's what the court's going to accept.
So if we remand it back and say that Lurk in its discretion can take new evidence, you want us to be sure the discretion is operated in a way that they would have to take it from both sides and couldn't take it just from one?
Oh, certainly, yes. One point I do want to bring to the Court's attention is in Adukumpu's reply brief on page 5, in referring to the defense vocational expert opinions, it says, and I quote, she lists employers in southeastern Wisconsin who had jobs Beecher could perform, close quote. She did no such thing. And when the Adukumpu comes, gets its rebuttal, I challenge it to present us, point the court to where in the evidence or what employers the defense folks cited. The unrebutted evidence in this case regarding availability of work was the evidence presented by Mr. McReynolds, and it established that there was no work available consistent with Mr. Beecher's physical, mental, and educational limitations. Mr. Sobota cited this court to the Wyoming case of Shapanovich. If you read that case, you will see that there was no vocational expert opinion presented in that case. If a person were to attempt to establish a claim for permanent total disability in a case like this present case without a vocational opinion, then maybe the section, the additional Larson section that Lurk is citing could come into play. But in Shapanovich, there was no vocational evidence. In this case, there was. And so on the question of whether or not Mr. Beecher established a prima facie case, Shapanovich really is of no help. The Minnesota case that is cited, that was a, you really have to read that case to see how little it means to this case here today. It's a claim for temporary total disability, not permanent disability. Under Wisconsin law, there would be no mitigation requirement. An employee is not required to apply for work to receive temporary total disability. That's established by Administrative Code Section DWD 47 and this Court's decision in Brinkbush Brothers. That Minnesota case refers to one specific time period of Minnesota law, and Minnesota's changed its workers' compensation law back and forth many times. It's really not very persuasive at all. If you look at some of the other cases cited by the defense, Guyton and the Second Injury Fund, the two Iowa cases, in both of those cases, the employee presented an expert vocational opinion. The administrative agency found the person to be less than permanently totally disabled despite the expert vocational opinion. The Supreme Court said, no, this employee established a prima facie case set aside the administrative agency decision and remanded the case. I also strongly dispute the appropriateness or the persuasiveness of citing the amount of money that Mr. Beecher would receive under the workers' compensation law if he is permanently totally disabled versus permanently partially disabled. By that I mean if he's permanently totally disabled, he should get – this is not an equitable court. LURC is not an equitable court. It's LURC's job to determine what the extent of his disability is, and then by operation of law, he gets the benefits. And I just need to, I have to recoil a little bit against the idea that Mr. Beecher is generously compensated in this case in light of what he has lost. I'm not going to go in great detail about that because obviously it's not an irrelevant issue in this court. If he is in fact totally disabled, he is entitled to permanent total disability benefits. I have time available, but so if there's any questions for the court, but.
This process looks expensive.
I don't know quite how to pose this question. This isn't really a legal question. We had a case last term, the Crystal Lake Cheese Company case, in which a young woman, in one sense, was a quadriplegic. Certainly, she was a paraplegic. And the effort there was to get her back into employment. And a burden was imposed on the employer to put her back into employment. Here we have someone who, and maybe I'm wrong, seems to be far less injured physically, who the argument is being made, they don't have to do anything. And I'm having trouble reconciling these two fact situations.
Okay. First of all, regarding the extent to Mr. Beecher's disability, well, obviously he's not a paraplegic, but his disabilities are not minimal either. He has had 3 back surgeries. The last one was a fusion. Additional surgery has been recommended. The testimony contained in the record and in the transcript shows just how severely his impairments affect his abilities. The functional capacity assessment that was ultimately adopted was based upon a functional capacity test that was performed, and he testified that was the most physically active that he had been in any day since his surgery. He uses a TENS unit, but he can only use it every other day so it doesn't lose its effectiveness. He used the TENS unit on the day that he did the functional capacity test. So Mr. Beecher is obviously, in my opinion, that if there's a distinction between obviously impaired and not obviously impaired, even though Mr. Beecher's impairment is not paraplegia, as that person, I submit that Mr. Beecher would fall in the obviously disabled as opposed to not obviously disabled. If the court were to establish that he has to apply for all these jobs, the question becomes, is that going to do any good? If it's not, we're wasting a lot of people's time. And the evidence presented in this case establishes that it would not have done any good for Mr. Beecher. He could have applied for all those jobs that he was unqualified for. But what would the point have been? He was already determined by the United States government to be totally disabled from any substantial gainful activity. Was Mr. Beecher reasonable? I think he was reasonable. I can understand why he did what he did. He did go to job service. He needed the help of the people there to try to use the resources available there. He took that and found that they didn't have anything for him. So could he have gone back to job service again the next week to do the same charade all over again? Or to do it again? Well, at that point, or at some point thereafter, it would have become a charade. So I think to follow Lurk's lead in this case is to, would be to encourage a charade of that type. Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Kelly. Mr. Wade, you've got 2.5 minutes.
Thank you. Opposing counsel has asked me to address my expert's vocational report, and what it contains is what's commonly called the labor market survey. It identifies categories of jobs within Mr. Beecher's restrictions and what U.S. publishes a thing called occupational titles, and she discusses occupational titles that it appears he should be qualified to perform. She lists numbers of jobs within those categories. That's, I think, all that's required under Beecher. That's standard practice within our area of the bar to do that kind of thing. From time to time, when you get to try to be more persuasive towards our burden of persuasion, you can take it up a notch, so to speak, and, you know, do a job search and contact specific employers and say, well, I see you're advertising for this kind of job, and I've got a person with these characteristics. Is this someone you can hire? And sometimes both sides do that to try to win over the administrative law judge to their position or the Labor and Industry Review Commission eventually. Is it required? I don't think it's required under Balshevsky, but I think that we see that relatively often within the practice to try to put in the most persuasive case. But
Counselor, your opponent has said that his vocational expert looked at the jobs available in Racine County job search, and that given Mr. Beecher's disability and lack of skills, that he really couldn't perform any of the jobs then available. Now, do you agree with that characterization of the report?
I'm not.
Because let me just tell you, my next question is, if you do, then how does your expert's generalized report rebut a specific statement of no availability of jobs? So that's kind of what I'm interested in.
Well, just as Brogan said, I think that's a good it's a good question. I'm not entirely clear. I didn't try the case, but it's my understanding. I picked it up at the Labor and Industry Review Commission.
I understand that.
It's my understanding, and again, I'm not entirely clear, but at some points in the record, it's indicating that he called employers, and I don't know that he asked them for work for his client, but he said he wanted to know, I see you've got a job posted. What does it require? And he came to the conclusion on his own that in my expert vocational opinion, I don't think my guy could do this.
Right. I understand. That's what I understood him to be saying. So you and I agree on that. I guess, given that, do you think it's sufficient then to rebut that showing and shift the burden of proof back to the employee by just a generalized statement that there are light-duty jobs in Wisconsin in these categories without any showing of availability?
My time is
up. That's right.
I think that, you know, in this particular case, I think Lurk looked at that. They looked at that issue. I mean, this is really the whole point of my entire case, is the Lurk did this weighing already, and they didn't find that Mr. McReynolds' action in that regard was particularly persuasive. I can't say that they thought it was a sham. I don't know what they were thinking, but they thought it. They didn't even think it was a prima facie case, really. As you can see, that's what they actually said. I think they got to weighing the evidence, and that's not really what happened, but they were particularly persuaded by it at all. I mean, the way we talk about this thing in reality is if you've got a vocational expert, you're an employer, and you've got a vocational expert who calls up and says, well, you know, I'm representing this claimant who's claiming they're disabled and they're suing their employer and these are their restrictions. Do you have any work for that kind of person? Mm-hmm. You know, that's where I think there's a certain, where if the burden gets that high, I think it's just going to be a sham, really. The labor market survey is intended to address categories of jobs that are available out there and try to show that those, due to the sheer numbers of them, that they're regularly available within the economy.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Wade. Mr. Sabota?
Thank you for your time.
I'll try and keep it real short. I'd just like to make 2 points, if I could. Let's go back to the second half of the Larson rule again. And we've already beat the bold face heading to death, but I do want to point out one thing. Professor Larson starts off that second part of the rule, and he says, quote, the corollary of the general purpose principle just stated would be this, colon. I took the trouble of looking in the big Webster's dictionary in our office what the definition of the word corollary is. And there are some smaller ones, but for the purposes of this rule, a corollary is, quote, something that naturally follows, result, or B, something that incidentally or naturally accompanies or parallels. So if the question that this court is asking the commission, why should we adopt the second half of the Larson rule, is because it's the corollary, the natural following or accompaniment of the rule that you adopted in 1977 in Balchivsky. And so given this court's long respect for Professor Larson in the workers' compensation area, I don't have any qualms about asking you to pick up the second half of the rule. The other really quick point I'd like to make, and if you look at the Commission's brief in chief, page 14, footnote number 3, I point out the fact that I think the Court of Appeals, when it interpreted the Balchivsky case, failed to distinguish the difference between the burden of proof and the burden of pre-production of evidence. And the Wisconsin case that I cite for that proposition is a case called Scholes, S-C-H-O-L-Z versus Industrial Commission. And I'd just like to read a very short, direct quote from the Scholes case, and it's from a 1915 decision of this case called Murphy versus Estate of Skinner. And so that would be 267 Wisconsin at page 41C, and it says, quote, from the Murphy case, it is not accurate to say that the burden of proof has been shifted because a prima facie case has been made, period. Where the plaintiff has the burden at the beginning of a trial, it remains with him to the end, unquote.
But there is a burden of production, Counselor, that slips in there, so the terminology is immaterial.
Not in this case, Your Honor, because, again, if we want to take Mr. Wade's analysis of the commission decision, what the commission did is decided everything. Burden of proof, burden of persuasion, burden of production of evidence, whatever you want to call it, and they came up with a result that he says is sustainable, and that's 60% loss of earning capacity. So what I'm saying is, don't forget the fact that Mr. Beecher is the one who's asking for 100% permanent total disability, and he has the burden of proof on that issue from beginning to end in a workers' compensation case.
Right. I don't think there's any dispute about that. I don't think he would dispute that either.
Of Court of Appeals seem to have some trouble with that concept, and that's why I bring it up again, Your Honor, because I don't think that their reading of Balchuski squares what this court had in mind when it decided Balchuski back in 1977.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Sabota, thank you, Mr. Wade, and thank you, Mr. Kelly, for your lengthy and erudite discussion on odd lots. Thank you. That ends our hearing on 02-1582, Beecher v. Lurk. The court is in recess until, I think it's the 27th when we have another oral argument. The court will meet in the conference room.